Hello and welcome to this episode of 10 Conversations for 10 Years. I'm Amar, Chief Quality Officer at East London NHS Foundation Trust. And in this episode, we're going to explore the topic of improvement capability and capacity. And absolutely delighted to have joining us today, Dr. Bob Lloyd from the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, where he's Vice President. And as many of you will know, Bob has led IHI's work on capacity and capability building around the world for many years and is a real expert in this field. So absolutely delighted to have him join us for this episode. And hosting with me today is Pedro, Vice President from the IHI. So welcome, Pedro.
I think you're joining us from Heathrow Airport.
From Heathrow Airport is right, Amar. Thank you. And it's so good to be here. And Bob, it's so good to have you here in a truly global call once again. We'd love to start. You've been in this journey from the very start in the partnership with East London Foundation Trust. And we'd love to start with a question that is common in the efforts to strengthen improvement across organizations. And is this difference between capacity and capability for improvement. So can you elaborate a little bit about what the distinction is between those two concepts?
Yeah, sure. First of all, thanks, Amar and Pedro, for this invitation. It's been a wonderful 10 years together, and I'm honored to still be part of your family in an ongoing way. I think one of the mistakes healthcare leaders make is thinking that capacity and capability are the same thing. Many people think they're synonymous. Capacity, just like my water cup here, has a certain volume that it will hold. And it's the same with people's learning. I can remember a time when I was working with a group of nurses in a training program, and it had several sessions. And I didn't see one of them at one of the sessions. And I saw her in the hallway of the hospital. And I said, Martha, you didn't come to the session. Are you all right? And she goes, I'm just full up. I'm just full up. I can't learn anymore. I've just got too much. And she was telling me her capacity was reached. Capacity is filling vessels with water, with coffee, filling things up. And a vessel has a certain capacity. And so people think that by sending staff to training for 3 days, 4 days, whatever, that they're going to fill them up and make them capable. Capability is very different than capacity. We do need to fill people up with new knowledge, skills, talents, concepts, methods of quality improvement, but then we need to see if they're capable. That is, giving them protected time to be able to go out and apply this new learning that we've filled them up with to see if they can actually use it, to apply it to make things better for those we serve. And so oftentimes, leaders confuse capacity and capability, and you hear things like, oh, we've trained 70% of the staff. Oh, we've trained 75%. And you go, whoopee, what are they doing with that? Well, we can tell regulatory bodies or other groups, the board, that we've trained 100% of the people. And then they wonder why nothing changes. It's because they focus on capacity, filling people up, but they haven't turned them loose. It's like potential and kinetic energy, letting them have time to actually work on the processes that need to be improved is turning it into capability.
Well, I remember when you first came to visit us in East London 12 years ago now, maybe. And, you know, we were just thinking about how we might reduce quality improvement. And it was a little bit difficult to comprehend the scale of what we were undertaking because we had thousands of staff. We had hundreds of teams. And knowing where to start and who with was actually, we didn't know how to do that. And I remember you telling us then about the notion of dosing that you had developed. And it's a notion that people are now being applying all over the world and thinking about how to build capacity and capability. Can you just talk us through what the dosing concept is and how a health system might apply it?
Good. Yeah. It's an interesting journey, actually, and you folks were a central part of testing my various theories on how this works. Originally, when I started this with Kaiser Permanente and then the Health Quality Council in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, I approached them, and as we were talking about building this capacity and capability within their organizations, I asked a simple question, who needs to know what? And so at first, I didn't call it the dosing approach. I just said, who needs to know what? And people would look at me and say, well, we're just going to one size fits all. We're going to send everybody to training. I said, no, you don't need to do that. You need to figure out people at different levels of the organization, macro, meso, micro levels, who needs to know what about the science of improvement in terms of their role in the quality journey. And at one point, I got thinking about how one would go about this. And at first I had numbers where it was like one was a little bit, two, more, three. And then what happened is people got so hung up on the numbers. They started, oh, we need a five. We need a, you know, we need a high score. And I said, no. This isn't about scoring. I was feared that somebody was going to start red, yellow, green graphics and rating and rankings. And then I got thinking one day, why don't we do this as we prescribe medicines? That is, if the three of us were on amlodipine, a blood pressure medicine, one might be on 5 milligrams, 10, 15. We dose the medicine according to the need of the patient. And so that's when I started using this term of dosing. Why? How do we dose the science of improvement? And using the medical analogy of pharmaceutical titrating drugs and how we prescribe things, we could be on the same med, in this case, the science of improvement, but we get different doses depending on the need that we have. And the second part of that was then, how do we deliver the dose? And if we think about medicines, we have pills, we have ointments, we have IVs, we have shots. And so just like we dose medicines differentially to patients based on the need, we should dose the science of improvement differentially based on the learning styles of the people. And as you well know, the typical adult learning of kinesthetic, auditory, visual, and we think about how we can dose that learning. Some people enjoy going to an in-service training. Other people would rather read, maybe do the IHI Open School videos. They'd have a dialogue, a discussion. So everybody shouldn't be sitting in seats for 4 days being fed the science of improvement. We should, first of all, dose it differentially based on the needs of the people in their role in the science of improvement journey, and then dose it in terms of how they would like to receive it. The other thing that came out of this, and it actually came from an inquiry from the NHS, that somebody at some point referred to this as the dosing formula. And right away, I got this note from a colleague in the NHS that said, well, how many people do we need to train? And I said, why? Well, we saw your dosing formula. So that's when I started saying, this is not a formula. It's no magic number. It's not an algebraic equation. It's working with an organization to do a diagnostic journey to figure out who needs to know what, in what dose, and by what method.
Bob, let me just build on some of your reflections, which have been so well illustrated. There's been a lot of work that you've done with ELFT, and there might have been some things in the realm of improvement capability that might have been, you know, stronger in terms of impact around creating a culture of continuous improvement. So what aspects of improvement capability do you think have been most helpful in creating a culture of continuous improvement across ELFT?
Well, I think the simple answer is leadership. When we first started, Robert Dolan, the chief exec at that time, wonderful man who saw that quality was not a hobby. He saw that it was a way of life. And given the challenges that East London and other trusts face, he had the vision to say, yes, this is how we should proceed. That is to make quality our organizational strategy. And I find that a lot of organizations actually think that quality is a hobby. Nobody today wants to say they're against quality. Nobody says, I want to get up today, put my clothes on, and go make things worse. And quality has become so ubiquitous in our literature, in our talks, particularly in healthcare policies these days, where people are pressed to become an HRO or other high-level functioning organizations, that without leadership, it falls on fallow ground. And so right from the get-go, the thing that we did with East London that made them able to achieve results faster than anybody we'd ever worked with is the fact that it started at the top with a vision, and then they started putting the structures, the processes, and the culture in place. So when we started working, Maureen Bisignano, Don Berwick, and then eventually Derek Feely and I were working with the board. So Amar would help us set up sessions with senior management, and we would work teaching the senior management team what they needed to know about quality improvement, the finance people, medical people, operations, clinical administration. And we would have sessions all day where we worked with the senior management team first. And therein lies, I think, the secret. A lot of organizations that ask for our assistance think that it's something that you just work with staff. It's a staff thing. We've delegated that to them. And I asked chief execs, well, let me ask you this question. You have a finance department, yeah? Well, do you delegate finance to that department and not get involved with it? Oh, no. You know, I meet with the finance people every week. Do you meet with the quality people every week? No, they're down the hall. They take care of that stuff. So I think that one of the key things, and that's become a kind of a marker, if you will, as we work with organizations, were they like ELF? That is, senior management got involved. The message got conveyed to the middle management, senior leaders, directors, and then down to the frontline staff. And then we started laying out our dosing strategy. But it started at the top.
I think that's really true, Bob. We wouldn't be able to do anything really without that senior commitment and the constancy that we've maintained, I think, with some variation, as you'd expect, over the last decade. I think the other thing is also that, it wasn't just words. People learned and applied it very quickly. I know you personally came and ran six programs of Improvement Science in Action, which teaches people the skills and the methods and the tools and gets them to apply it to something in their service. And that was just within the first two and a half years. So, that's pretty rapid, I think, way for people to not just hear that the organization's committed, but to actually get involved, to learn it and apply it to something. I guess one thing I hear now across organizations that are starting this work is, although they understand the idea of dosing, and they recognize it's probably not a magic number. You said there's no equation to follow, but is there a tipping point? I've often wondered this, like, was there, if I look backwards, was there a tipping point at which there are enough people equipped and mobilized to be able to really build momentum forwards? What is that, like Malcolm Gladwell would have put forward in his book, the tipping point? Is there a point like that in this kind of work?
Well, I think there is. And I think when we started to take the notion of dosing, and we actually started laying out the methodology. So whenever I start doing this with a group, we start with making a big table on the wall, whiteboard or flip chart pages. And the rows are the content domains of the science of improvement. The column headings would be the relevant groups within the organization, starting with senior management, non-execs, board, physician leaders, nurse leaders, whatever the major groupings of staff within the organization. And then we would start looking at topic by category of workers and figure out what dose. And that's when I started using shades of blue for intensity. So the darker shade of blue was the deeper dive. And it ended with people on the far right side of the matrix that were the quality experts. And so it also gave us a chance to show an organization, where do we need to focus? And it's on all of these. It's not just one. And I do think that Gladwell's notion of a tipping point makes sense. And we hit that tipping point very quickly at ELF. There are some organizations that, quite honestly, have not hit that point, even though we've worked with them. And it's, again, because senior management, middle management didn't get involved. They thought it was a frontline activity. So you'll remember that one of the first things we did was to say, how many employees does ELF have and where are they? So we looked at a map and we looked and realized we had Luton Dunstable out there. And that's when we started saying, what dose do people need? So at IHI, we have different programs. You mentioned the Improvement Science in Action. You'll remember that we had upwards of 200 people in those. So we did six of those. So now we're talking over 1,200 people. I worked with you and your staff. We ran two versions of the coach program where we had about 50 people in each of those. And then you started developing your own versions of those, as well as your own versions of the Improvement Science in Action program. In the meantime, Derek and I were working with the senior management. You were involved with that, as well as some of your staff. And then you'll remember we even covered your governance bodies. And then you kindly set up with the CQ counselors and commissioners. And we went to the Law Society and had a large group of the CQC people come to learn about it. So then we started looking at the people that have an influence on ELF, not just internal. And so that kind of diffusion, I would say, was also relevant. We haven't seen that level in other organizations. So I think there is a tipping point. And as we started filling out, we made that triangle with quality experts all around the edge, and then the different groups, senior management, board, all the way down to the point, fewer people that were the quality experts, your department. And that allowed us to start saying, for all the different categories of employees, where are we in percent penetration? And when we hit that point, I would say it was probably about half of the employees that tipping point started happening. And it, you know, it's not a magical number again, but as people have looked at this, there have been different opinions on how much it takes to have quality across the organization. And some people have proposed that you take the square root of the total number of employees. That's how many quality experts you need. Others have said you really shouldn't be but a couple steps away or a phone call away from a quality expert. And I think that was also part of our guidance, because we said you need the improvement advisors, where you're with us for a whole year, getting equivalent of a master's degree in quality improvement. And both of you have been through that training, and now you teach with us. And you don't need a whole lot of those, but you had about 12, 15 full-time quality improvement people who then could support the hundreds of coaches that we developed, who then can help the teams. And each level has different knowledge level, but it comes back to that expert level group that knows the concepts, methods, and tools. Coaches know the care and feeding of teams. So different people had different assignments, but it was your quality department then that served as the focal point to help people figure out who needs to know what, and then how can we apply that in our daily work?
Bob, again, each question builds on the other. There's something you said earlier around the difference between learning by, let's say, watching a YouTube video or sitting in an hour-long conversation versus applying the skills. And I just wonder what reflections you have in terms of the ELF journey, in terms of the balance between people accessing the knowledge and having access to those basics versus people applying the knowledge, and how important is it to keep a balance, or how slanted should you be in the practice versus just the theoretical knowledge?
That's a great question, Pedro, because gaining knowledge, filling people up with capacity of the knowledge, the bits and bytes, even tools and methods of quality improvement without application is theory that goes nowhere. If you don't take this new knowledge and apply it to solving problems, then it was just a theoretical exercise. You may have learned a few things, but are you making things better? The end result is really to improve the care we deliver, not only to our patients, but to those who work with us. And so it became very clear from the beginning that management understood that this is about work. It's not about just putting people in seats and training X percent of the population. And so from the very beginning, people had projects, and that was the essential aspect of what we do. If this is not applied to daily work, then in fact, it might get people out of work for a couple days to go to class, have some lunch, meet some friends, but has anything changed? And so you all know that at IHI, we don't teach theory alone. The whole focus is on projects and work and making things better. And that really comes from the frontline staff. They know how work gets done. Management at the top of the food chain, smart people, bright people, but they're removed from what happens every day. And so it's that synergy between people in leadership management roles and people who do the work. This was Dr. Deming's key point, that management needs to realize that if you want to improve anything, you've got to talk to the subject matter experts, the people who do the work. Elft got that from the beginning. So that's why we didn't go in stages and say, now we're going to work with the senior leaders, middle management, front line. It was a top down and a percolating up that kind of joined in the middle. And it was all focused on improving aspects of work. We developed very early on some very nice diagrams that showed various domains that ELF wanted to work on. Clinical service, patient satisfaction and engagement, staff, joy in work, efficiency. And so there were these domains that created our dashboard. And then within each of those, projects were identified for improvement. And so without projects, this is just an interesting theoretical exercise, which is something we don't do.
There is something around the starting point for many organizations who are looking at, let's call it the improvement journey. There is a starting point, and oftentimes that starting point is just building on some assets and history that they have. But for organizations that are at that start of their improvement journey, what steps do you recommend they take in developing their capability plan?
I think one thing at a kind of a high level, Pedro, is thinking about what's our model and what's our approach to quality improvement. There are many different models that have been used successfully around the world. At IHI, we use the model for improvement, which is structured around the work of W. Edwards Deming, Walter Schuchart, Joseph Juran, as some of the initial early thinkers, mainly in manufacturing, but then we've adapted that for healthcare at IHI, and we use the model for improvement, where you have three questions, as you well know: your aim, how will you know that you've been successful, which is the measurement question, and then what changes do you propose to move you from here to there? And then using the PDSA cycle as a way to test these ideas. But there are other methods that have been shown to work. Lean, Six Sigma, ISO, the Baldrige Award criteria, the International Quality Awards, the Toyota Production System. All of these work. I think the challenge for healthcare is having what Deming always called constancy of purpose. And so organizations that in my mind, have kind of the flight of a butterfly. Oh, I've seen groups say, this month, we're going to do that model for improvement. Oh, next month, we're going to do lean. Now we're going to do Six Sigma. Nope, now we're going to do lean Six Sigma or Six Sigma lean. And they look for quick solutions to complex problems. And those problems didn't happen overnight. And they're not going to go away overnight because you picked the latest buzzword or methodology. Constancy of purpose on your methods, your concepts, and the cultural transformation will make the difference. And ELF has shown that consistency. They've used the model for improvement. We've developed it, refined it, adapted it to their organizational goals, principles, and values. And so I think it's that constancy of purpose, Pedro, that allows organizations to pursue improvement in a consistent way. They need not the flight of a butterfly that's, ooh, here's the latest shiny thing. But my analogy would be like, you know, an eagle that sees that fish in the stream and has focus and direction. Whereas some healthcare organizations, they're just like butterflies. They're whatever looks the latest shiny thing. An elf had focus, direction, and then they put into place the structures, the processes, and the cultural transformation required to make it a reality.
I'm just going to take a stab at summarizing some of the highlights of your reflections, Bob. It's not enough to create capacity for improvement or build capacity. You need to also build capability. The dosing notion is a notion and it has no perfect formulas, but it's a really helpful way to frame the importance of fluency around improvement across the organization and at different levels in terms of key aspects of improvement capability. Leadership support and leadership activation is hugely important. It's not enough to learn in a classroom the theory. It's pivotal to practice the skills of improvement and learn by doing. And at the start of the journey, it's really important to consider constancy of purpose and frame the improvement efforts as a constant rather than a one-off short-term effort. So those are some of the highlights from your reflections. And I think the journey of ELFT is continuing to inspire people inside of the organization, and the leadership over time has remained despite the changes in leadership human beings, which is remarkable. And they're going to continue building on their infrastructure, on their improvement capacity and capability, but as importantly, and probably most importantly, on the impact that they continue to achieve. So, Bob, thank you for today, and thank you for the role that you continue to play in that partnership.
Well, and good summary, Pedro. And you know, from our work together, as we've done diagnostic visits and looked at other organizations, they have achieved marvelous things. But one of the things that really has impressed me is the fact that we were able to move ELFT away from using red, yellow, green RAG reports to control charts that went to the board within a year and a half. We have never seen that in any other organization. To be able to move from static data for judgment RAG reports to actually looking at the variation in their key domains over time, that was a leadership movement. They understood that they needed to look at variation in their processes rather than rating and rankings and where do we fall against some arbitrary numerical target or goal. And so that to me was one of the highlights of their accomplishments. And we've never seen an organization do it as quickly as ELF. And today they produce daily hundreds and hundreds of Schuhart charts to understand the variation in all of their processes. And that alone is a major accomplishment. I'd say the final thing that impresses me is they see this as a journey. Yeah, we're marking 10 years and it's wonderful. But I've heard people say, from MR's quality group to senior management, it's a journey. And we're still on that journey. And as you rightfully point out, we've lost some of the senior leaders, unfortunately, but they've been replaced by people that had the same mental model. And that's key. That gives us that constancy of purpose. And so this journey will continue, and it will continue to be successful, thanks to the leadership and to the managers and to the quality department that serves the science of improvement implementation.
Thank you so much, Bob, for joining us for today's episode. You've been part of ELFT's journey for the last decade and longer in helping us prepare for the work we were going to start doing. It's been a real privilege to have you with us in conversation with Pedro today, thinking about the topic of capacity and capability building, which, you know, for almost every organization trying to do this work is a core component. So really great to get your advice and wisdom to help everyone who's on this journey together.
Thanks again for your time.
Thank you, Pedro and Amar. It's an absolute pleasure, and I look forward to our ongoing journey.
Thanks, Bob, and thanks, Pedro, for joining me today, and hope to see you on the next episode.